you start with three strikes against you. You are a woman. You are a Jewess. You represent the communists. Those were the three strikes against me. Well, said I, before I go reply to the two other strikes against me, why is being a woman a strike against me? I didn't like that any more than I liked the others, you know. You see, we have staff here. We have an office staff. And we have a conference every morning. We have a morning session. And each lawyer, the staff consisted of lawyers who carry on the work, report their experiences with their mothers, with the children they have. But it's not all work with us. We like to have a little fun. And very often, some of the boys tell jokes that are off color. And they'd be very uncomfortable if a woman was at the table. I said, can't you change the color of your jokes? He says, well, it's the humor, all right, but that's the story. At any rate, those were the three strikes against me, and I never got that. So I went back, and I didn't realize that it was a blessing in disguise, a disappointment, because I would probably have been saddled there and trapped in that kind of work and never got out because I was working for someone. Mm-hmm. I'd have gotten first-hand experience with the mothers who need legal aid and the children and all that, and maybe rendered them service, but I wouldn't have done what I did. So I went back and brushed off the finger marks from my desk, and went to work as I started out in the first place. And the little fees that came in, how little they were, I kept paying off the creditors. My husband had a lot of creditors then when things went bad and started owing people money.
What had he been doing all of these years? He didn't remain a conductor then?
No, he did not remain a conductor. He went into the real estate business. And at that time, foreclosures were left and right. And whatever investments he had, there were foreclosures. Mm. And he was stuck with the deficiency judgments. See? And so I had that on my hands.
So this was the Depression of 21.
Pardon?
This was the Depression of 1921,
really. Not 21. That was already in the 30s. That was in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Well, it was, I would say it was the late 20s and early 30s. Mm-hmm. Because I know Saturday, a number of my clients had me take care of their bank accounts. And across the street there was a bank that was considered a workers' bank. It was the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers mm-hmm. bank. And the building I had my office in had the same name. In fact, that's where I injured my back. Through a doorknob, they had a locomotive embossed on the doorknob from the lobby to the restaurant. And I walked out one day, and that doorknob hit me in the back and broke my vertebrae. That is one of the vertebrae. So I remember I hurried Saturday. The bank closed at noon. Hurried with my money. You know, fees mm-hmm. were brought in on Saturday when the people had working. And the people that my clients left and made the deposits, you know, and went home. And Monday morning, we found the bank was closed. The banks were closed. That's when all the banks were closed. Mm-hmm. So that was a bad period during that time. And that's when unemployment councils were formed, and I worked with them, and other workers were different things. I had many a run-in with judges who regarded me a pretty red lawyer In fact, looking through the files here, I saw in the 30s, where I was representing men before the National Labor Board, National Labor Board, Labor Council, where they reported that they made some kind of a deal with the defendants. And the organizer of the group and two more was represented by Yetta Land, and she was in the courtroom, and that led to a packed courtroom, I suppose, waiting to talk to a packed courtroom, but she didn't get a chance to because they made a deal, the other lawyers, there were other lawyers representing the others, made a deal. But my clients, whom I represented, I noticed they signed the contracts so that nobody could challenge my right, a contract to represent them before the National Labor Board. Well, there were demonstrations and marches, and the veterans, there was a veterans march. And the battles of the unemployed was something that one had to live three lives over again to experience the heartbreaking things that people live through in the unemployment day, and that's coming to home to me now, what is happening when the people say, I worked so many years, and on there. So just a few illustrations, and you know what I'm talking about. They used to have social workers, and the social workers were girls who had some college education. They were considered the upper strata. And they were assigned to look into the homes of the unemployed who are getting relief to see how they live and where they get the money. So one social worker came in one morning to a woman who had school children, I don't know how many, and she came during lunchtime. They used to come during the meals with it to see what they eat. She noticed on the table, and it was early in the summer when things were high, she noticed sliced tomatoes on the table. There was bread and milk, and I think fresh sliced radishes, you know, something like that. So she looked at the table, and children about ready to eat or eating. She says to the woman, well, you eat very well, don't you? She was a foreign-born woman. She says, what you mean? What you mean? I see tomatoes. Tomatoes are very high now, aren't they? Radishes, very high, aren't they? And this poor woman burned up because in addition to washing clothes, going out washing clothes while children were at school, and she lost a lot of customers for washing clothes, she had a garden in the back of her yard. She cleaned up the yard, and she used to work day and night nurturing that garden. And she finally reaped the benefits of her labor. She was able to pick some tomatoes, the first that sliced it for the children, and put up a nice table for them. So she says, what you mean, what you mean? She says, I said, tomatoes, she thought it should talk loud, she'd understand it better. Tomatoes cost lots of money now, and you got lots of tomatoes on the table. So she took her by the hand. She says, you come with me. And the woman, the girl, got frightened. She started to pull away. She says, no, you come with me. You see what I pay for the tomatoes. You come and see. And she took her to the backyard, to the garden, to show her how. Well, the girl reported that she was attacked by this woman. See? That she was attacked. And they arrested her, charged her with assault and battery. And then she came to me for defense. See? This woman. And I said, we're not ready for trial unless the court is ready to give us a jury. Well, you're not entitled to a jury. That's a misdemeanor. That's a misdemeanor. I said, but I want a jury. We want a jury. And what's more, battery is not a misdemeanor. You didn't just say assault. It's assault and battery. Battery is not a misdemeanor. Well, we'll give it postponement, but we'll see about a jury. And then the jury commissioner came to me. He said, Mrs. Lamb, I want to show you something. And he took me to his office. He says, you see this? And he showed me a dry ink well. We have no money for ink. The city has no money for ink. And you are asking for juries. I said, well, that's too bad. But this woman's rights are very important to me, ink or no ink. He says, what's the difference? He says, maybe they won't even put her in jail. A few days, but you'll have a record against her, won't you? Don't you think having a criminal record means something to a mother? Well, he says, you're incorrigible or something. He waved me off, he says. And they got me a jury, and I defended this woman, of course, and got her acquitted. I told him how lavishly she is. Mm-hmm. And I said, if the court will permit or request for the jury to view the scene, because very often they take the jury out to see the scene of the crime. I says, to see the scene of the crime, I'll be very glad to have the bailiff accompany us. And yes, the jury wanted to go to see. And then the judge talked it over and talked it over, and they denied me that. They couldn't take the expense of taking the jury. Well, the jury had a letdown, and they knew what the score was. And anyhow, they were not, I don't know, I don't think it was 30 minutes, and they acquitted her. See. Well, I didn't get any friends in the courtroom by the jury commissioner and the judge and so forth. But that is an indication of, and then I started to battle, I think, when I ran for judge there one time, where I told him that what I would do if I were a judge, I'd advocate that these cases should be handled as the equity cases.
You know, that was that on the Farm Labor Party? Or was that...
Well, the Farmer Labor Party, I ran for prosecutor on the Farmer Labor Party. We had cases out there. They were not ILD cases. They were private cases there. One was a woman shot her daughter-in-law. She aimed a gun at her daughter-in-law, and they imprisoned her and different things like that. Now, I want to get away from this phase of it. I just want to see, there are some high points before we get actually into the ILD cases and the criminal cases. I had one assignment case of a first degree murder, and that's the only murder case I had, of a woman. And I got the assignment not because the judge loved me or he wanted me to have it. But the case came to me in a strange way. This woman was arrested and charged with hanging her husband. Hanging her husband. And that's a first degree murder charge. Now, she didn't come to me, but a friend of hers came to tell me about it, and so I went up to jail to talk with her, and I signed in, and when I'm through talking with her, she wanted me to represent her, and I signed up as her lawyer, so I was on record her lawyer, so he had to sign one that came for trial. And when it came for a trial, the judge's name was Corlett, I remember that. And one day the judge called me to his desk and he said, Mrs. Land, if you want to do your client a favor, you'll plead her guilty to second degree murder. Second degree murder is imprisonment, but it's not electric chair. Mm. You know, first degree murder used to be electric chair. I said, it's a very tempting offer, Judge, but I'm afraid I have to run the risk of doing her a disfavor. But I will talk with her about it. So I did. I went back to jail and talked with her about it. said, Mrs. Lange, you do what you think. You do what you think, you know. Well, it was a case that took a long, long time. And you know what they had to do? They had to, they exhumed the body of her husband, which was buried, I think, 2 years prior to that. And the coroner, who was one of the chief government witnesses, seeing in these murder cases, it's not an individual, it's the state versus Tom Brown. And this coroner was the chief witness for the state. He testified the condition of this man's spine and testified that when the prosecutor examined him, the prosecutor said to him, would you say that it was possible, and of course I claimed suicide, my defense was suicide, mm-hmm. And he said, would you say that in the case of suicide, that such a condition is possible? And the prosecutor, the coroner. The coroner thought and thought for a long time and says, no. Well, I took him on cross-examination. And I went through the cases, how long he's been dead, and how the process of exhuming a body before they hit what they want, before they get the coffin and the condition of the coffin, and removing the body and the fact that they removed them from the box and put them on slabs to examine him. Now, says, having all that in mind, would you say that it's possible to sustain a broken collarbone, a broken spine, with all that, after 2 years of burial? He gave a very reluctant yes, it is possible. I didn't want another word. And we went to trial, and it wasn't a hurry verdict. It took a long time. And the judge was at me more and more. He called me in his chambers. You still have a chance to change your plea. You still have a chance to change your plea. I said, sorry, Your Honor, I may be bullheaded, and that's it, you know. Well, when the jury came back, I watched them. I wanted to see their faces, you know. And one did this to me, you know, and I couldn't believe it. Anyhow, the verdict was not guilty. It was not guilty. That was the second trial. I'm not going to first. The first one was a hung jury, see? The second trial, and he always reminded me about it. See, that time he says it was a hung jury. Some of them were for conviction. Now they'll all be for conviction. Anyhow, when I got a hold of her, I took her home with me. She hadn't a home at that time. And started to go out. I was down the lobby. The jury was all in the middle of the lobby. They didn't go away. And would you know, left and right, they started kissing me for all hours of work. They were so happy for me and for that girl, you know. But if I should tell you the defense on that would take all day and I won't. But anyhow, that is the only first-degree murder case I had. But civil rights cases, there were plenty, and private cases. And our purporter later, and I think in 36, my son graduated from law school. While he went to law school, he was my secretary. And I always say the only time I had a real secretary was when I had him, because he was perfect. He was a perfect typist, stellar, and his language, his grammar was good. So, in 35 or 36, mm-hmm. I think, he graduated law school, and we started practice as the law firm of Land and Land in the same building.
In the same Brotherhood
of Locomotive Engineers building, in the same building, in the same office, because at that time Mr. Drake retired. Drake was the man that I rented from. Mm. His name just came to me. See, before I called him Clark, but the name Drake just came. And Mr. Drake retired, and I had two rooms. Part of the time I rented it out to two people. I don't know what business they were in. They were not attorneys. And then we had the lobby and one stenographer for all of us, for both of us. But when Jerry graduated, I asked them to find another office, and they did. And I went downstairs, and I talked with the landlord of the building, the manager, and I asked him. And that wasn't a panel. That was a door, an original wall, I mean, between the two rooms, two offices with a wall. I said, would you, if I shared part of the cost, would you remove that wall and make one large room out of that? Because you're going to have two lawyers here for a long time. Maybe not me so long, but the other one is young and has got a long career ahead of him, a long practice. He says, well, I don't know how many years I've been managing this building, but I never had such a request. But I will give it some consideration. And would you know, I don't think it took a week when the answer was not only yes, but he won't take any money from me. And they removed it on weekends. They removed the wall. I don't know how they worked so fast. And we were set up in a new painting, a new carpeting, a new beautiful room. And it was the size precisely of these two rooms. Exactly. Because when they were separated, they were a little larger than this. But I like these two rooms. And I had my desk on one end, he and his, so they were faced each other all the time. And I was not, with a capital N, I was not hard on hearing then. And so we'd hold our conferences from each other's desk. And that's the way we practiced until trying to figure out when it was that I think it must have been in the early 50s when I retired, and he remained there himself in that office. But we practiced together all the time.
Now, so he was involved in political cases too then?
Oh yes, oh yes. He handled any case that came in, we decided among ourselves which one would handle it.
Oh. See?
And a little characteristic about our work and about him, when a case came in and after we discussed the facts a little bit, next time I looked up, he wasn't at his desk anymore. Where was he? Upstairs in the law library, digging for the citations that apply to this case. That was Sherry. He was very meticulous, and he was good, because I know this lawyer, this Judge Corlett, met me on the street one time when he was in a different courtroom. I think he was in the probate court, where you probate wills, you know. And my son had worked there, a foreign will, that he had a probate. It involved a marriage and all that. And Judge Corlett wasn't too happy with my winning that criminal. So whenever I met him, he'd go this, he'd stick his finger in his collar, kind of started choking. But this time he stopped me. He says, that son of yours is a mighty fine lawyer. He's a mighty fine lawyer, so I know when he said that yeah, he was a good lawyer. But he used to decide a thing so much faster than, so much slower than I did, see? He's so good in everything, and I wondered why he was so slow. And I think I'd arrive at snap judgments. I was quick, and he was more thorough. Mm-hmm. He was more thorough than I was. He didn't leave any loophole anywhere before he filed a case, you know, before he took it and talked with the client, you know. He's a good lawyer, all right. I remember one time I got a letter from, did you ever know Joseph Brandt? Or of him, B-R-A-N-D-T.
No.
He was an official in the Foster group, and I don't know what they call themselves, the Communist Party of America or something. He sent me a report on a case that was out of the city. Jerry handled the case. And he says, as far as the lawyer is concerned, all I can say is that he's a chip off the old block. In other words, that is complimented him. He's a good lawyer. Well, that is the story. But after we both closed the office is when I was taken out of retirement into the criminal syndicalist cases, into the Smith Act cases. There are more recent years. The case on Foley Square, I was in that case 9 months.
What is it? Was that one of the Smith Act cases?
That is the criminal syndicalist case, I'm pretty sure.
No, I know.
Criminal syndicalist.
In one of the articles, that you had won a decision in the early 30s declaring the Ohio criminal syndicalist law unconstitutional. What
was
that case?
Those were cases of young people. I think, I don't know how many there, but seven or so. They had a meeting in small town, Yorkville or Marysville, Somerville, on the public square, talking against conditions in a bucket factory, where they were cutting their hands there with the metal, and it was pretty bad. Conditions were bad, and they weren't getting anywhere. If they try to organize, you know, they called in the goons and all that, you know. So they thought of an idea, since they're talking so much about the constitutional rights to living and to better conditions and living conditions, that they would go and they would take a few articles of the Constitution, print off enough to distribute at the meetings instead of a leaflet about their conditions. So at this particular meeting, there's a woman by the name of Betty Gannett, and she was an official in the party, an important woman. She was introduced as the speaker, and she had a desk full of those leaflets. And she started to say, she says, you know what we're here for, and she talks about it, but anything I can say will not be as important as for you to take one of these leaflets, take it home and read it, and if you don't understand it, get a hold of someone who does understand what it's all about, and then see if we have a right to ask for better conditions in the factory and better wages and so forth. And at that time, the cops moved in and grabbed her. And as the cop grabbed her, she grabbed a handful of his handbills and she threw them as far as she could, and the wind carried them, spread them. And, of course, she was arrested and the others with her. And I was called in to defend them by the ILD. And the trial was held in something that looked like a garage to me, and the judge was the mayor of the town and the everything, you know. And they started a case, and the police took the stand and identified the defendants and stated that they were distributing subversive literature. See, subversive literature. And so the judge said, I said, do you have any of that literature with you? Oh, yes. So the judge or the prosecutor handed him one of those leaflets. And that was that. So the judge says to me, you ready for your side? Yes. I said to him, is this the subversive literature that you're talking about? He looked and says, yes, that's the same. That's the same. Was a lot of it there? Yes. Was it distributed? Well, she threw it, and the people around there, they all took it, and that distribution, isn't it? I says, yes, you are right, it's distribution. Oh, I said, I assume you read English, don't you? Of course, you know, very indignant. I says, would you please read it out loud to the judge? Because, you know, the judge has to be the jury, too. I think he has a right to hear. So he read it. I don't know how many articles mm-hmm. were on a reprint, a sheet this size, mm-hmm. you know. So he read it all. I said, did Your Honor hear the reading of the subversive material? Yes. I move for a discharge of all of the defendants on the ground that there is no subversive literature in the record shown. He looks at me and looks at the policeman and turns around, I'll overrule you, Mrs. Mrs., I'll overrule you. So I just sit there with my mouth open and says, Mrs., I overrule you. All right, Your Honor, then I will introduce evidence. I had with me a volume of the Constitution, you know, and I had it marked off. I turned the page and I took it to the policeman. I says, would you please read this out loud, this evidence to the judge, because His Honor, and I emphasize honor because he was a fat slob, you know, sloppy guy, you know, is entitled to hear the evidence before he decides what we're supposed to do. So he read the Constitution. He read those articles. And here and there, I says, can you tell me where, let's start with number one, article one. Read that and read that. What is the difference? You seen the difference? And he is so flabbergasted and so confused. Now I read the second one and the third, you know, and all the time he had no choice. I says, Your Honor, I renew my motion on the ground that the state witness, Officer so-and-so, just read from the Constitution. I don't know if it's the High Constitution, Constitution, Article so-and-so that provides for this and provides for that and not for the record, which is one and the same thing that he read in those handbills. And if the court is in doubt, we certainly can recess and give the court an opportunity to examine the volume and these handbills. We had a recess, a long recess, and he came back, called the court to order. This is, I overruled you. I says, go ahead, you overruled me. What's your decision? I find the defendants guilty. I find them all guilty. So the ILD stepped in and put a bail for them. And I hurried right back to Cleveland. This was some little mm-hmm. suburb there, because the Court of Appeals was in the county, you know, in Cleveland. And went to court of appeal and filed, went to the office and had the proper petition on appeal, you know, for, I forget the name of that appeal now. Anyhow, it's an appeal for reversal of the court judgment on the ground of nowhere. And put in my evidence there, in the evidence, the handbills and the book. And I asked for an early hearing. Well, I didn't care, but I asked for an early hearing. Well, this was so controversial. So much of it came around the talk about it that the judges from Cuyahoga County refused to hear the case. And they called in a visiting court. It was common to have visiting court when a thing was too controversial, that they might take sides knowingly or unknowingly. And the case was finally called into court. And this new court read the appeal and the prayer of the defendant, so-and-so, is granted in full. And the verdict of guilty at such and such date is hereby reversed, null and void, and so on. It works to that effect. And as I was there, and as the kids were all congratulating one another, the presiding judge of this visiting court came up to me. He was a tall, and he reminded me so much of Debs. He had such a fine face on him. He came up to me and says, "Mrs. Land, I wouldn't be able to sleep if I would think of that tousle-haired girl," that was Betty Gannett. She had curly hair, you know, wavy hair. "If that tousle-haired girl was in jail one day," he says, "I couldn't sleep at night." And he says to me, "Congratulations, you did a good job." And the judge. So those are the type of satisfactions that I had with these cases.
So that even though you were seen as the red lawyer, and I'm sure somewhat it must have been scandalous, they still were able to respect you.
Oh, yes. I know. They were, the Court of Appeals, there was only one judge in that Court of Appeal, Vicker. He was the owner, the father, because the father and the son. The father was one of the oldest judges in this Court of Appeals, and he was the owner of the first year of law school that I had, of that law school. It was a private law school. He was Vickery. And he was a very conceited old man. Whenever he would make a talk, he'd say, "Well, everybody says that old Vickery can slide on the smallest cake of ice of any man they know." He's the only one in the Court of Appeals that showed his antagonism for me, because I was giving for these people that they considered outcasts, the reds, the lawyers, and the red lawyers. But everybody else had high respect for me, very high respect
for me. How did the newspapers handle the accounts of your cases? Was it always the red lawyer?
No. In this particular case, they did, because they were very angry at me, because I didn't want any deals. I didn't want to make a deal. And the lawyers who were hired by the other defendants wanted it, see? So that's just one reason. But in this Paul Casey case, outside of the first degree murder case, I consider that my greatest victory, because that's where Judge Wanamaker declared this criminal syndicalist Act, or was it Smith Act? I forget. I use them intermittently because I read the same way, both of them. But I think it is a criminal syndicalist law. It involves sabotage. declared it unconstitutional because they were ready to throw away the key. I think I have said enough. If we're not going to get into these later years, I better quit right here. And I'll take a few minutes to show you some of the newspapers, since you asked for the newspaper reports on these cases. Because I know one time, and this is a very interesting thing, it wasn't pleasant, but I represented a lot of black people, a lot of Negro people that time, because the fight for the Negro people was at its height that time, and yet it was very low, you know, it was the beginning of things. So that when they got a white friend, they stuck with that friend. And so I had a lot of Negro cases, because the old story, the first to be hired, the last to be fired, vice versa. The first to be fired and the last to be hired. That's where they are. So I had a lot of clients in connection with the relief work. They weren't getting relief, or they were supposed to be chiseling, or this, that, the other, always things like that. So, and there was a newspaper, a black newspaper, and I forget the name of the paper, but I know the publisher was Ford. His name was Ford, F-O-R-D, Ford. And he came one day and he wanted to know something about the cases I was handling for the Negro people. That time it was Negro was the word. And I started showing him the files, and the 500 Negro cases for Negro people. And all but two were won. All but two. Well, he went and he prepared a very good article on my work for them. And she lost all but two. I was sick about that. Oh, and of course he scratched his head. And they apologized I was pretty sick about it. I didn't care so much, but after all, it's a horrible thing. You think I was deliberately getting them convicted. I had unbelievable cases. I had one case where a Negro man was arrested, and he was just walking the street. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't sleep for hunger. Past middle age, you know. And a couple of cops saw him, and just because he was black, they started pulling him in jail. And he said, "What are you all pulling me for? Tell me what I did. You'll find out. Tell me what I did. I want to." And they pulled him, and he got mad, and he took one and bit his finger, the policeman's finger. And, of course, they had something now to try him on that. And his finger became infected, and I don't remember whether he came in court with the bandaged hand yet or not. And the man told me this story, you know. And he says, "Honest Mrs. Land," he says, "maybe I was walking in my sleep, because if he said I did him, I suppose I did, but I know I don't remember that I did him." He says, my stomach was girding so much with emptiness, because I didn't know why they were doing it to me, and I didn't know why I was awake, why I was in the street. So I put up a defense that they gave him an uppercut. I asked for jury to send us and everything. An uppercut, and doing that, and the man certainly wasn't expecting it, so they hit on an open mouth, and that's the way that policeman hurt his finger. Needless to say, the jury brought in a verdict of not guilty, an acquittal. And as I was putting together my files, going out of it, a policeman comes up to me. This policeman is in here. He said, "Mrs. Land, what did I ever do to you?" You know, he felt terrible. I said, "You didn't do anything to me, nor your colleagues, but you and all your colleagues did plenty to my clients, and pointed to this man. You didn't stop to ask him why he's walking this time of this night out there in the cold, a man no longer a youth. You didn't find out whether he had anything to eat, for that matter, any place to sleep. You assumed that he was a criminal, and you were going to drag him. I said, so you did nothing to me, and I'm sorry if your finger became infected, I'm sorry. But not at this or any other case do I want to give them an addition to the record of being starved to have records of being criminals, because they are not.